The series on ministry and daily life. We talked on Monday and Tuesday about the church's ministry sponsorship from the National ELCA on ministry and daily life, and some of the biblical basis of why the church is really the lay people who are out there in homes and factories and offices and things like that during the week. Yesterday we focused more on ministry and occupations, on Tuesday. And now these two sessions, today and tomorrow, are focusing even more precisely on ministry with persons in business. I won't give a lot of biographical stuff that's posted up on the kiosk, but I do want to do one thing first. This is the ELCA has a Department of Ministry and Daily Life, and those of you who have not signed up to be put on the mailing list for their newsletters and things, you can do it. In some ways, the ELCA is the envy of other denominations, because we revised our constitution. Actually, we got a new constitution for the new church. And that constitution says that the primary area for ministry of this church will be the daily life of the members of this church. And that is a tremendous statement. I wish it were more true in reality, that we really encouraged, enforced, and said to the people, not just go in peace, serve the Lord, but some instructions or some help and encouragement to do it in offices and factories and classrooms and hospitals and all those places. So if you want to sign up for the newsletter, please do so, and we'll put it on there. One of the questions I guess you might have in mind is, what is a nice Lutheran pastor like me doing, talking about business and ministry of persons in business? Let me give this. There were a few influences in my life that made that possible. Interestingly, the first one was when I returned from World War II. I'd been with the 8th Air Force in England. And returned to college, and I needed one more physics class as a math and physics major. And I decided that the only one I thought I could really handle, having been away from it for a while, was contemporary physics and its philosophical implications. And so I said, that sounds like my kind of physics. And it turned out to be a traumatic experience. The professor, Peter Frank, had come over during the war from Charles University. He had replaced Einstein there and was all into this new physics and everything. And I had been a Newtonian physicist. Now, I learned the mechanical world, where marbles bounced off each other and you could measure them, and matter was indestructible and all those good things. All of a sudden, I'm exposed to a totally new world of relativity, quantum mechanics, indeterminacy, and it was a shattering experience in the sense of having my world destroyed. I was very secure as a Newtonian physicist, not a physicist, but a Newtonian, who knew for sure that it was just a matter of time before we dissected enough to find for sure that there wasn't any God out there, and things like that. That changed my frame of reference, really, to start seeing the possibility of God in things. Because I wasn't an atheist, maybe wasn't even an agnostic. I was just a do-nothing Christian, my dad was a pastor. That was another complication. And I was a good, obedient son. I went to church even when I was off to college because he knew the pastor. and all those things going for me or against me. And that led me to my first real trauma. I went on from graduating to the Harvard Business School, intending to be an executive. And the fall of my first semester, my father became very ill, and I was told to come home because he was really dying. My father was a good German Herr Pastor type of pastor, except that he was also very political. And we used to have arguments about whether you could really put up with the kinds of things the members of the congregation were doing and things like that. And I thought of him as a professional Christian. And I was a professional Christian son, so I behaved that way too. And in his dying, I became a Christian, really. Because of the confidence that he had. You know, Luther said, "I fear the grave as little as my bed." And that was my dad. He was absolutely confident, you know, that he was on his way to heaven. So I said, you know, this is serious. This isn't just a way of making a living or something. And so I got more involved. I had a very good pastor at school, and he got me involved in Lutheran Student Association and some things like that. First thing I knew, I was being asked to go to the World Conference of Christian Youth in Oslo, Norway, in the summer of 1947. And then I can remember going into my pastor and saying, "Now this has gone too far. You know, I have no business representing American Lutheran students over there." And he said, "Well, you're probably right, and I'm not so sure you should be going, but maybe God wants you to go." He gave me that encouragement. And meanwhile, he got some members of the church to provide some of the additional funds I needed to fix up that. So I was off to Norway. The theme there was Jesus Christ is Lord. I knew that. I learned that since I was a little boy. But I didn't know it was a political statement. I didn't know the choice was between Jesus Christ as Lord or Caesar as Lord. And the people were being put to death for saying something as innocuous as Jesus Christ is Lord. Yeah, and it was interesting. It was at the time when the Dutch were fighting the Indonesians. It was the first time that any Germans came out of Germany after the war to an ecumenical conference. Well, the Lutheran World Federation had met just a few weeks before to organize. This was a whole new vision. That is why I like the Bible study so much this week. Because we're talking about the positive aspects of the law, you know, God's in kind gift of his intentions for peace, justice, and integrity of creation and things like that and in the world was how I happen to be here today, you know. I finished my business school, and by the time I finished, I decided I really wanted to be and should be a Lutheran pastor. But I had a lot of not anxiety, but uncertainty whether I was copying out on the real world, you know. So I am here tonight, once again, doing penance for a copy in the real world of management and business. Tomorrow I want to talk more specifically about the question of the role of business in society. I did an article 20 years ago in the Harvard Business Review with the question, "Is business the source of social values?" With the thesis that the values of business tend to become the values of society, so that the people who are managing offices and businesses are in our American business-oriented society, those tend to become the values of society, and I want to look at that a little more. It was written, I say, 20 years ago, but it probably is truer today than it was when it was written. About 3 or 4 years ago now, I got a call out of the blue from Norman Lear, the All in the Family producer and all. And he said, "I've just read your article from 1971 on business and social values, and I want to know what's happened since." You know, and because he was giving a talk to the Young Presidents organization, it ended up with some correspondence. I didn't know you could really accomplished so much with facts. And by the end of the week, I had given him a revised version of his speech and things like that as he eventually gave. But I think it is a question, and we'll talk about that tomorrow, though. The question I often begin a seminar, a business people, when we've got time to do a lot of interaction, which unfortunately we won't have tonight, How do the people who work for you go home at the end of the day? Do they go home feeling good about themselves, having used their God-given talents, having accomplished something, and the feedback that you gave them, the way you organized the responsibilities? Or do they go home feeling frustrated, you know, one false move away from out the door, you know? Do they go home to their families, ready to share, and go home even to committee meetings at church? Or do they go home, you know, so anxious about themselves and mad at themselves that they take it out on their families or take it out on themselves and never quite get home as they duck into the local pub? Shortly after I graduated from business school, I went to an alumni conference. And I was in a group of people who were mostly personnel managers. And they had them divided for production and marketing and things like that. And it happened to be a time when a lot of strikes were going on around the country. Now, I was one of the early classes at the business school. I was there 46 to 48, where they were talking about human relations. You know, and they'd done this research that Mayo and others had done on if you pay attention to people, they produce more, you know, and things like that. And we bought into that as business school students. You know, we learned what we were supposed to do. You know, pipe in music, you hire social workers, you have recreation clubs, you do all those things to tell the workers they're important. And some of the recent graduates were really getting after some of the faculty, because they said, look, we did all you told us to. We piped in music, et cetera, et cetera. And now they don't appreciate it. They're out on strike. And the fellow who was leading it was a Dr. Ullman. He was vice president for personnel of Standard Oil of Ohio, a very fine Christian person. He said, oh, you guys are smarter than that. You know, this was before we had women at the business school. You know why you're doing what you're doing. You're doing it to get more out of the workers. And you're still the boss, and the boss names the game. And the game is who can get the most out of whom. And you shouldn't be a bit surprised that the workers are trying to get the most out of you by what's available to them. And then he made this statement. The only reason why a company or a manager should care about the fulfillment, the happiness, the well-being of the people who work for the company is because the company or the manager does care about the fulfillment and the well-being. You know, that's a different kind of question. Because you can look at two companies with identical personnel practices and policies, you know, and the workers will know whether one company is manipulating them and another is really caring about them. Now, this is part of the problem we have in our society today, is we go for these quick fixes. You know, you read In Search of Excellence, you know, and you got a blueprint for how you can do it, and you put that into effect because you want the results, and there's no caring about people. So, you know, that made me think more than I had before about the nature of the person making decisions. Now, all I was doing at the business school was learning how to make decisions. And when I started studying ethics in the Lutheran Church, that's all I was learning how to do. George Farrell, who's one of my people I admire a great deal, has a book that I used many times on ethics of decision. And it's a good book. But the decision maker could be interchangeable. And any person, you know, who can think should go through the decision-making processes. And my interaction with Roman Catholics, particularly over the years, has gotten me into this whole idea of formation. You know, and who is the person? What kind of values? It's the kind of thing that I've enjoyed in the Bible studies on James, you know, because James is concerned with you know, who am I? What kind of a person am I? How can I do things with the right motivation and things? It's Tuesday at the seminar, I was talking about resources of the Christian faith with a person in vocational life or in occupations. The question of who am I is a great resource. If I know my own personal worth as a gift from God, that I don't have to prove it by my accomplishments, my success, my bank account, or my titles, or whatever, then I've got a freedom that enables me to function in the world, and particularly maybe in the business world, because the business firm holds most of the rewards that people want, you know, the titles, the salaries, the perks of one kind or another. And if I need those perks to make me know that my life is worthwhile, or my existence is justified, to get close to justification by grace alone, which is really what the whole thing is all about, they can get me to jump through hoops I didn't even know existed. Because I need those rewards. I may still desire them and want them, but to need them is a different dimension. And that goes to the character of who we are as persons. It's also been good to be in this setting where there's a lot of Lutherans, they're not all Lutherans, you know, and the Bible study particularly coming from a different theological perspective has been great. One of the things I do with the class I teach on ministry and daily life is hand out a sheet on the stumbling blocks of Lutheran theology for the ministry of the laity. You know, all those good things like justification by grace turn out, when you really look at what the lay people think when they hear them, is I don't need to do anything. In fact, I better not do anything. Because if I start thinking, it's dangerous. Because if I accomplish something, I may think that's going to help my salvation, and then I'll get prideful, and then I'll help. And so don't even think about doing good things. Now, that's a bit overdone. But also, we are, as Lutherans, terribly Christ-centered. You know, and that's important, and it's great. But Christ-centered is not the whole of the Christian message. Certainly not all of the biblical message. You know, we have a very weak creation understanding, a creator understanding in the Lutheran Church. And that's the whole environmental, you know, the care for the earth. We still want us to do it. You know, we become literalists or something. But even more, listen to the Spirit. Lutherans aren't very good at that. You know, that's the Schwammerei, as you know. If you get studying about the too much spirit direction, and you won't be thinking enough, you know. So I'm delighted for the kind of interaction, because what I hear as I listen to these different perspectives is that we are in a both and kind of world. My physics last course taught me that too, you know, that when you know that light behaves as a wave and a particle at the same time, that didn't fit my Newtonian thinking, you know, or my either-or kind of Lutheran theology. You know, you look at the Augsburg Confession, we believe this and we don't believe, you know, that's all the things we don't believe, you know, and I think we got to be more open than that. It's got direct consequences for business management. There was an article 8 or 9 years ago now in the Harvard Business Review with a very interesting title. That tends to be a bottom line kind of publication, but this was Managing the Paradox of Organizational Trust. Now, everyone knows how important trust is in an organization. I should talk up to it. Everyone knows how important trust is in an organization. But who knows what it is? You know, I'll trust you under these conditions. I'll trust you if you do this. I'll trust you unconditionally. Well, maybe not in my organization. You know, and so the author does three kind of tongue-in-cheek assumptions. The first one is kind of the do or die, which is the either-or kind of approach. If I'm a manager, I'm right, you're wrong. This is true, that's false. And as soon as you get set up that way, your trust is gone, communication is gone, because people are smart enough not to suggest anything that the manager disagrees with. You know, we do become smart along the way. And so communication is cut off. And I'll talk to managers, you know, and more even with consultants who work directly with companies. And they'll go in and the boss will say what a wonderful communications they've got and things like that in the company. And you scratch around a little bit and you find everyone's scared stiff of the old man. You know, and no one wants to say anything. And so he's got a bunch of yes people around. And you don't get very far in a productive, let alone a trusting organization. The second has something had to do with the long-term, short-term. You know, and we are infinitely placing more value on the short-term, tangible results in a business setting. Someone calls it the tyranny of the 90 days of those stock market reports that have to come out on quarterly balance sheets. The long-term, less tangible, probably more significant results don't get much attention at all. So part of what we have to do is get over some of these assumptions. Incidentally, the third one is good guys finish last. And the author who says, you know, in spite of everything we write in behavioral science and the importance of good management and listening to people and all of that, the reality is that you better pretend to be tough and hard or you don't get the respect of people. You know, there was... And somehow we Christians have to break out of some of that. In the 70s, I had a very interesting time. California Lutheran University set up an MBA program. And the president decided that he had been head of the head of the business department setting it up said, we're a Christian school, we're going to have a course in ethics. That's in the MBA program. And he was going to teach it. Well, then they made Mark Matthews the president of California Lutheran University, and he said that if I teach it, he'd still make it a required course. None of those people, and this is 1972 that I first taught this course, none of them wanted a course in ethics. You know, they wanted, you know, bottom line kind of results that they could use in the business. And it was fun joking with them about, well, I don't know why you want an MBA. If you just want to know, you know, nuts and bolts kinds of things. Because if you're aspiring to be management, you need to know about business and society. You need to know about values. You need to know about determining directions and so on. And I said, well, I'm going to start reading the papers, you know, the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times business section, Business Week, etc. Bring me in articles to share with the class about where you see ethics as involved. And first, they couldn't find any. You know, by the end of the course, I had to cut off the time because they were being able to see the implications of things for societal values and for the future, long-term future of the company that they weren't before. Let's see how this comes out. Why don't you put the right switch, I think it is. Now we could do a course in ethics and business. We could do a couple of days seminar. But some of the things, you know, when you talk about internally managing a company's ethics, the first one up here is legitimize talking about ethics and values. If you don't find a way, and it usually has to come from the president or the manager of the subsidiary, whoever that legitimizes things, that we want to talk about the ethics and values that are operative in our company. What are we saying about values in this particular action or that particular action? And that becomes an important activity if you're going to move into serious, talking seriously about ethics in business or about values in business. And then clarify the company's values and standards. Companies now have mission statements and codes of ethics and things like that. I tried, back in 1958, I tried to write a doctor. I was the first one they admitted in the doctoral program at the Harvard Business School in the area of ethics and values. And made my mistake, really, was trying to write a thesis on the role of ethics and values in teaching business administration. You know, I think of myself as a fairly astute person, but that was naive as could be. The dean was partly to blame because he thought it was a great idea, but he didn't know that the faculty was doing everything he wanted to do in ethics under protest, because he was one of those executives that wasn't that good communication. The idea that you can talk about ethics and values is legitimate, or that a company should have ethics and values didn't get very far at all. And if we don't do that today, we're not doing it. Reward behavior consistent with values. When I'm talking with people in a company, first thing I want to see is their performance appraisal. What are they rewarding and what are they punishing? I was involved in a program on international business ethics. And before that, before we did the seminar, in fact, we did it at Gustavus Adolphus College, I interviewed a number of San Francisco companies on how do they implement their statements about ethics and values. And the best companies did it right in their performance appraisal. They rewarded, in Levi Strauss, for instance, 40% of the bonus is related to the way in which they have fulfilled the aspiration statements of the company, which are statements of ethics and values. Create systems that support ethical behavior. That's the same kind of thing that we do in a performance appraisal. It's a fuzzy area in business ethics right now, because there's a lot of companies that have ethics programs. You may be aware that that's for the Department of Defense mandates companies with contracts with the services for military production to have an ethics program. Well, how you communicate that ethics program? You got to go, don't pay much attention to it, but you got to go because we've got to have it, or when the company is serious. My experience from some of my colleagues who have made quite a bit of money doing this sort of thing is that they think that it's a farce. They try to bring it in and then they don't get invited to batch the next year and teach the course. If they put too much pressure on how does this relate to your company policies and things, they're not a nice overview, Encourage internal whistleblowing. When I'm doing a seminar, this is the one that gets the most trouble right away. Well, what are you doing? Well, you're getting people to snitch on each other. Going back to the Nazi school teachers or the communist world, ratting on your parents, all they do. But I actually would prefer to state it now as, what can you do to make whistleblowing unnecessary? Because if you are saying that you believe in environmental soundness, or you believe in affirmative action and fairness to all races and sexes and all in the organization, and you really mean it, and you say to all the people in the company, we want to know when there is something going on, that is not producing those results of better environmental behavior and better human relations, then you're opening it up for people to respond to what you're doing. But there's a, we can get into talking about any one of this. Help employees anticipate ethical dilemmas. This is most people do have dilemmas, and unless there's some awareness that the company realizes this is a dilemma, and it's not an easy, you know, black or white, either or kind of decision all the time, you will they need some help to learn how to anticipate ethical dilemmas before they actually come to the surface, and then help employees develop skills in analysis and development. Because we can come back to any of these later when we you want to give me life so I can see what's as I in the occupation section that I did on Tuesday, I talked about some resources of the Christian faith for the prison in the management world, or in any occupation. Actually, I've got a handout that I think, for those of you who weren't at any one of the Tuesday session, I got enough for you to have, which kind of summarizes all I've talked about this week. But those resources, I think, are very important. It's dangerous to talk about the Christian faith as a resource for my life as a business person. But you know, the alternative is it's not a resource, and I don't need to think of it as something positive in my business life. The first of these is this "Who am I?" question. To know my own worth and value, so that I am confident of who I am, and if the company can't get me to jump through those hoops and things like that, you know. But the knowledge of my own worth is well, I talked. You look at cases of suicide. And most of them have found meaning to life somewhere. You know, there's my experience at Cal, in the 50s, that was, the national average was for suicides, forget what it was, but Cal's was five times that in the number of students attempting suicide. And the chaplain or the campus pastor, I was visiting them in a hospital. And the pattern was usually the same. Something was giving meaning to life. And maybe it was a PhD, you know, and then they ran across the statistics class or the language class, something they knew they weren't going to make it, and so intelligent, logical people, they decided to end this meaningless life. Or they found another person to tell them their life was worthwhile. They would love, you know, and then something happened to the relationship, and they no longer knew in that tangible way that life was worthwhile, and they ended it. Well, this whole emphasis of translating justification by grace to the gift of meaning, I think, makes a tremendous impact on our understanding. And I think to know that my life is worthwhile and I don't need all these things that I may want, as I said before, is going to make a great deal of difference. The second, another resource of the Christian faith is a vision of society. Another thing I'd like about the James Bible study is the positive emphasis on the law. You know, I grew up, one of the things I couldn't understand in the Psalms was this, "I delight in the law of the Lord." Now that didn't make any sense to me at all. You know, because the law was the things that told me what I couldn't do and all of that sort of thing. But to realize that God has told us what the good life is, that we have a vision of true humanity and true community. It takes a lot of translating into how you manage a company, how you relate to an organizational structure. But the awareness that we're not without help is a very helpful resource to have. But we need to find a much more way of understanding that. I'm talking a lot about James lecture. It's from the Methodist. This is a free Methodist. He said they are free Methodists, but they're not very free. It's with the whole idea of perfection. I call the third resource of the Christian faith for people in business freedom from the compulsion of perfection. Now, that has little to do with the goal of perfection or the striving for perfection. It has a lot to do with thinking I'm perfect or pretending I'm perfect. And that's something that I don't know whether it happens really more in business, but it certainly happens a lot in business. When we start thinking of ourselves more highly than we ought to think. You know, we think that we are the ones who made the company successful. We are the ones who know everything. And you've cut off communication, going back to that organizational trust article. But the idea that you can... I've been over here on this, but I don't want to use it. The freedom from compulsion of society. From freedom from the compulsion of perfection. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't seek perfection. I just don't pretend I am. Because if I... Well, I don't know what I was trying to remember. There's a book called What They Don't Teach You at the Harvard Business School. It's kind of humorous in some ways, but very insightful. There's a chapter, they don't teach you to say I made a mistake. They don't teach you to say I'm sorry. They don't teach you to say I was wrong. You know, and if you can't do that, again, you cut off communication a great deal. And you've cut into productivity, which usually gets their attention when you mention productivity. The fourth one is the gift of community. And most of our congregations have a number of people in different occupations, you know, who are in healthcare or in education or in management of some kind. And we don't do a very good job of bringing them together. And that's what the emphasis in this division of it's in the ministry division, but the ministry in daily life department. Is trying to do. Unless we have an opportunity to share with one another, we're not going to get very far. Well, we've still got about 20 minutes, so what did you think I was going to talk about, or what did you like to come back to and all?
There's a standing joke in my school, a business professor, and we have a AACSB, it's an accrediting institution, which requires an ethics component in classes. Mm-hmm. And we had initially thought about having a business ethics class. We have it. Now we're getting rid of it. Professors are saying that they're teaching ethics in each of their classes. We asked the students, did they teach ethics? And they say, huh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it's a continuing joke. I'm just wondering, what are the best ways for the semi or non-knowledgeable business professor to teach ethics in any of the business courses like marketing or management or whatever?
That is a real dilemma. I'm involved very much in the Academy of Management and in their Social Issues Management Division. And I was on the curriculum committee for trying to design what a curriculum should look like for a business school. One of the big questions is who's going to teach it? Unfortunately, most business ethics courses are taught by philosophers. The philosophers who aren't getting enough students find this as a way to get more students. And of course, historically, ethics is a subdiscipline of philosophy. And they're the ones that can tell you all the deontological and utilitarian and all the theories on ethics. Problem is, they don't know management. And so the tension is whether you should have management people teaching it or philosophers. If a management person is teaching it, the management person is so accustomed to the pragmatic, what works, short-term solution that it takes quite a professor to get out of that role, and in fact, they know that they're out of that role. Harvard Business School, maybe some of you were, this is about 4 or 5 years ago now, got the largest grant they had ever gotten, a gift from the former head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, who said he got tired of seeing so many graduates at prestigious business schools and law schools ending up as convicted felons. Since you got to teach ethics. And he gave, it amounted to, with matching gifts, something like $30 million. Harvard had just done similar to what she did. They had just let go the three people on the faculty that had anything to do with ethics. And then they got this grant. Quickly kept one of them on, but just for a couple of years, because he already had an appointment elsewhere. They must have really bought him off to get him to stay. A good man, but a philosopher, you know. But now they've devised a program for the first, well, they've been teaching it in the first semester, towards the end of the first semester of incoming into the 2-year program at the Harvard Business School. And it's a 3-week program. But every course is taught by a senior faculty from finance, from marketing, from production, or from human relations, or personnel, whatever. And these are the same professors that are going to be teaching courses later on. And so they can't, you know, put on an ethics hat and say ethical things for 3 weeks, because they're now, you know, public, they're accountable. There's some question, I've talked to some of them back at the school, and some of them feel that the first semester is too soon. You know, they're still jockeying for who they are and how they relate to faculty and all. But there's no really good time for this to teach it. It's amazing, particularly through the AACSB. They've gotten the number of schools that are required to teach courses in business ethics is great increase. And when I was teaching at California Lutheran, it was one of the very few schools, and one of the very, very few MBA programs that had anything with ethics in the curriculum. So I think there's hope, but I think that it probably falls into a both and rather than an either or, whether it's a separate course or a separate course taught by a philosopher or a management course taught by professors of management in those sub-disciplines. Any of the rest of you have any experience with taking ethics courses at schools, anything like that? Okay, any other questions?
When you had your overhead, one of the middle elements was talking about rewarding employees who have maintained company values. I guess I take opposition to that and feel like you should penalize employees that do not meet company values, but it should be clear that every employee is expected to minimally meet them, and if they don't, they're penalized, not rewarded, because that kind of allows in my mind the idea that, well, this is what we'd like you to be, this is how we'd like you to act, but if you don't, that's not going to be a big deal.
Well, this Levi Strauss business, they the employees have very good bonuses. And if 40% of your bonus is calculated on whether you live up to the aspiration statements of the company, I guess that's rewarding, but it's sure punishing the taking away the 40% if they don't. So I think you have to work with both of them. I don't like reward at all, really. You know, I'm too loose for that, you know. You don't do things. You don't do things because your heart is changed and you're responding to all that God has done for you. But there has to be some accountability along the line. And I think maybe this is a step in the right direction. You know, shortly after I'd done, in the mid-70s, I was just in the economics department at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And we worked out a program with the Chamber of Commerce to take students that had had the ethics class and then were still around the next year to do an independent study. But essentially conduct a survey of businesses in Santa Barbara. We don't have corporate headquarters, but we've got a lot of branches of other companies. And the question was this: how does your company influence the values of Santa Barbara? And through the Chamber of Commerce, the students have appointments with the executives in various fields, in the investment field, in marketing, and in the JCPenney's and Sears, those stores. We had a lot of research plants and manufacturing plants. And they sit down in the office and say, how do you influence, as president of this, manager of this company, the values of Santa Barbara? And they started to talk about all the things except what the business did. And they said, well, you know, I'm active in my church or synagogue, and I think that's an important influence on the values of the society, of the community. I'm active in the with the Boy Scouts or in the boys clubs, the girls clubs in town, things of that kind. And when they reported back from the first round of interviews, I found practically no one mentioned what they did or their company did on the job. Even though, again, saying how important their church or synagogue was, they were apparently not being told by their parishes that they ought to be putting their Christian faith or Jewish faith, whatever, into practice in their businesses. And so we had to go back a second round and make it very specific what they were doing as company officials. Another thing, you know, when I first started to teach this course, I went out and interviewed a number of the companies in town, and I said, you know, what do you think of business ethics and corporate social responsibility? And as I said, these were managers, subsidiaries of companies elsewhere, and the interesting actually said, you know, I'm beginning to get these statements of corporate responsibility and business ethics and all, yeah, but I can't afford to pay attention to them. Because, you know, the only thing I'm rewarded on is the quarterly balance sheet. You know, and so I just don't dare pay attention to that. Well, I guess over the years, what had happened was these people who were not paying attention were producing good short-term results, and they were getting promoted, and then someone was coming in and finding what the mess was. That was the real company, not just what the quarterly balance sheet. So about, this would have been early 80s. I did a redo, and there were the same companies and one or two of the same people still there, but that had changed a great deal in connection with what you reward and what you punish. The quarterly statements had, I mean, the annual performance appraisal had questions about, you know, how are you living up to affirmative action guidelines? You know, what's happened in terms of the number of people with races and minorities that are in the company. What are the number of hours that employees have been involved in community activities? What environmental actions have you taken to improve the relation of your company to its environment? And then also, how is the quarterly financial statement over this year's time? And I got the impression that made a tremendous amount of difference. You know, so the question, you know, what you reward and what you punish is very important, because people were not getting promotions or bonuses and things on the basis of not performing some of these, what I think some of the professors at the business school would have said, peripheral things, rather than the bottom line.
I guess I have a problem with what appears to be sort of a top-down approach. I don't see how anything a president or board of directors can ever write is going to substitute for every single person in that factory or office being concerned and caring. There's no way anybody can watch what everybody's doing, and somebody that cheats on their expense account or only tightens that nut halfway or whatever, because, you know, for whatever reasons that people do it. And I guess to me that's the thorniest problem. How do we encourage an individual responsibility regardless of whether the president of the firm says to do it or not?
Well, this again to me is not an either or. I agree with you 100%. I'm talking about these managers who say, I can't pay attention to those high-sounding pronouncements out here because the reality where I live is something else. On the other hand, if the president is, or the manager locally is one who says, you know, focus only on the bottom line, and you get this in case studies and things. In fact, I brought along a case study that we might have done. But it's essentially someone who has done something that he's now going to the boss and saying, you know, this may be influencing children to use drugs, the kind of advertising that we're doing in a pharmaceutical house. And the manager says, oh, I'm awful busy, you know, but congratulations on the sales figures this month, and we need to talk about this sometime, but meanwhile, keep on doing what you're doing, you know. I'm talking about that kind of, not pronouncements as much. When things like quality circles and participatory management and things like that first came in, there was feeling that it was just Mickey Mouse. But you know, the places that are serious about it are finding that we use, what are some of those statistics, 20% or 10% of the capabilities of people who work for us. And that we could be using maybe even 50%, you know, of their abilities by enabling them to do it. But this whole business of manage is manage and work is work. You know, we think of scientific management and all of that as being something in the past. But you look at a lot of companies and you think it has just been discovered where I know all the answers. You come and ask me and I'll tell him. Now don't start communicating among yourselves. So I would affirm that very much.
How do you balance the ethical behavior against just the standard operation of a business? For example, a corporation typically has an obligation to shareholders to give them a respectable return on investment, grow their markets, things such as that. Yet in today's environment, the way you grow your market is typically to steal market share from somebody else. Right. And you can do it through a variety of practices, be it predatory pricing, whatever. So where do you draw the line between what is an ethical maneuver for the market versus something that isn't approaching an unethical?
You know, you take on a certain perspective, you know, of the free market and Adam Smith at his preciseness. And there's no way that anyone should be coming in with extraneous things, except for you know, how much money you're making. As long as people like Milton Friedman are affirming the need for any ethics or external factors, let the market control, we're in trouble. And now, I am not about to be in favor of government running business. You know, I've seen too much statism and all of that sort of thing around the world. But there needs to be, again, a both and. We need to get a better mix of the way in which companies are not in the tax structure rewarded for short-term activities, where they are severely punished for environmental. You know, usually it's a slap on the wrist if they violate environmental things. There are ways. You know, Germany is now going through this in eastern part, through the from its communism to the free market. And they have developed, in fact, in numerous places in Europe, what the concept of a social market economy, where the best of a social interdependence of people in a society and the benefits of a market-oriented production system are brought together. But in the United States, we don't want to even hear that word social in terms of capitalism. Now that's a big question, and I don't know the answer, but I think it's one we need to be very much aware of, is that we don't yet have the handles. And it's tied up with a whole lot of things. The senator was talking yesterday about the savings and loan scandal, and he was saying that we knew this was coming, we knew what it was, but no one wanted to touch the political hot potato, you know. And they had too many people who, incidentally, one of the books I just read this last month by John Kenneth Galbraith, who's a Harvard economist, called The Culture of Contentment. In fact, Dr. Galbraith was a speaker at the German Kirchentag, which they hold every other year, on this subject of the culture of contentment. And he says that we are so happy, we upper middle class voting public, that we will continue to re-elect the conservative people who keep things the way they are. We don't want many change. We want to make sure that the savings and loan don't hurt us. We want to make sure that we have a military to protect us. But the poor, and again, James's priority of the poor is something we need to take seriously as Christians, doesn't come through. Okay, wait a minute, before I... Did that slip get around there's a slip there for anyone who came in late to be on the mailing list for ministry in daily life. There are some books that I thought good of human hands. It's little vignettes about working people, managers and workers, on the A Reader in Spirituality of Work, and that's in the bookstore. And the Once and Future Church is I think a very significant book. It's by the one of the people at the Alban Institute. We grew up in a culture where we were in a Christian culture, and our neighbors were Christian. So the mission field was overseas, you know, and we sent missionaries over there. This has the subtitle "Reinventing the Congregation: A New Mission Frontier," and that's a good. And there are. This one's not up there, but there are some other books by Bill Veal, who used to be sales manager at Bethlehem Steel and is very active in the Lutheran Church's laity movement. And I've got some copies of this, Resources of the Christian Faith for Prison in Business.